Good morning,
counsel. You wish to reserve any time?
Well, I'm going to buck the trend, not 3 minutes, but 4 minutes, Your Honor.
Oh, all right. Something new. Proceed.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, Richard Llewellyn Jones, appearing on behalf of the plaintiffs, Mr. and Mrs. Beverick. Before I go on with my comments, does the court have any questions based upon its meeting yesterday afternoon?
The decree of foreclosure orders a sheriff sale of your client's property, as I understand it.
That's my recollection.
The record doesn't tell us whether that sheriff sale has taken place. Do you know?
To the best of my knowledge, Your Honor, it has not.
But is there any reason to believe that the sheriff sale will not take place?
I have no reason to believe one way or the other, Your Honor. Okay. I believe that the order, as it's currently written, provides that remedy, but you might ask that question of my colleagues when they have the opportunity to address the court.
Well, let me put it another way. Is there any reason to believe that a trustee sale will ever take place?
Well, that's a much more problematic question because, as the court is aware from looking at the clerk's papers, the matter was brought after the notice of default was issued, but before a notice of trustee sale was issued. So we don't have a couple of documents that we would customarily look to determine the rights and parties, like a beneficiary declaration and a statement within the notice of default.
Well, I understand all that, but my question is a simple one. Given the fact there's a decree of foreclosure that orders a sheriff sale, not a trustee sale, is there any reason to believe that there ever will be a trustee sale?
Well, I think it's quite unlikely, but it's possible.
Okay, thank you.
Under the current status of the law.
I have a question. It appears from the record that the appellants here, the plaintiffs below, agreed to the case against MERS, Bishop and Lentz, and U.S. Bank being dismissed. So how can they argue error now, since it was agreed below?
Well, you've caught me at a bit of a disadvantage, as I was not the trial lawyer at that time. I looked at a cold record to try to determine what, if not, the appellants might have. I don't know what became of that stipulation, because we now have, in the course of an answer, affirmative defenses, that all those claims got resurrected. So even though there may well have been a stipulation to, you know, excuse U.S. Bank to pursue the deed of trust violations and the CPA claim, those whatever issues, claims and issues that had been stipulated to be dismissed were resurrected when U.S. Bank appears as the under a judicial foreclosure in an answer and affirmative defenses and counterclaim. I don't know what the politics of that were. So I'm at a disadvantage, Your Honor.
Then the other question I had was with regard to the allegation that the affidavits in support of summary judgment were insufficient on evidentiary bases. What would you see as a sufficient affidavit?
Well, I would start, Your Honor, with personal knowledge, at the very least, an honest, and I understand this court's position with regard to Bevan 2. The client was able to reach agreement with the lender and did not ask me to pursue. We now have those issues before the Supreme Court on a writ of discretionary review in the Connor case. But I would tell you that I would at least expect, go ahead, Connor, Your Honor, discretionary review was filed about 2 or 3 weeks ago. The bottom line, Your Honor, is personal knowledge. If they're going to use records, provide the damn records, please. Please let us know what you're relying upon so that we as trial attorneys and the courts can understand what it is that they're saying, on what basis, what's the quality of the information that's been provided. As is stated in these, we were presented with a counterfeit note. Now, I will advise the court that in the common usage, those sorts of documents are all right as between lenders and their certificate holders. They can use those back and forth amongst each other because they trust each other. They're on the same side of the equation. Pooling and servicing agreements, typically authorize that. But when you take that document and then try to foreclose against a party's home, that we've crossed the line on.
With regard to Mr. Beverick's affidavit about the note,
yes, sir.
Does he say that the note is a counterfeit note or that he can't tell, that he has concerns about the weight of the paper and the color of the ink?
Well, those are indicia of that gives a basis upon which you get beyond a conclusory statement that it is wrong. Okay. What he is telling
He doesn't court, say that's not my signature though.
No, he what he is saying is that that's not his signature because it's the wrong ink. It is a representation. That's what counterfeiting is, Your Honor. I get a plate from the U.S. government. I create $3 bills. I start sending them around. I've taken a plate. I have created a document that looks, for all intent and purposes, with the Secretary of Treasury's signature on it. I start passing them around. It looks like his signature, but it isn't. It isn't the original note.
Or your position is there's a material question as to whether it's not his note.
Correct. And that was sufficient to have this matter remanded to the trial court for further hearing, which is what we request.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to set aside 2 minutes for WMC Mortgage. I represent Adam Hughes, representing Horror Bank, U.S. Bank, MERS, Nation Star, and Bishop and Lynch of King County.
Let me ask you a question as the lawyer for Nation Star, which I understand is the judgment creditor.
Yes, Your Honor.
In the decree of foreclosure. I take it there has been no sheriff sale of the property? Or do you know?
As it has been referred, they've been attempting to sell. The last news I have was that it had not been the sale, and that was approximately a month ago. For some reason, the sheriff said, I can't go to sale. This is on appeal, which I responded, there's been no bond.
Okay. Well, let me ask another question. Is there any reason to believe that there will ever be a trustee sale?
No.
Given the fact that there's a decree of foreclosure ordering a sheriff sale?
Absolutely not.
All right.
The court would like me to address the untimeliness of appeal argument. I think this would be an issue of first impression, and I think that the summary judgment order, while not containing the analysis contemplated in the Nelbro packing case referenced by Mr. Jones, does contain written findings and express determination that no just reason for delay exists for entry of judgment, as is required by CR 54B. Additionally, all of the factors identified in the Nelbro packing case weigh in favor of judicial foreclosure judgment being treated as a final judgment in this case. The relationship between the adjudicated and unadjudicated claims is distant. They're having no effect on each other. The issues remaining at the trial court are not questions that are relevant to the appeal of the foreclosure decree. The need for review would not be mooted by future developments at the trial court because all that had to do with was monetary claims against WMC. And immediate appeal of the foreclosure, which should be in everyone's best interest to address before a sheriff's sale did happen, and should have happened by now, candidly, would not have to delay the separate handling of the claims against WMC. And now, just referencing the sheriff's sale, the practical effects of allowing media appeal are the strongest factor here. The ability to protect against a sheriff's sale that would be ordered, otherwise a sheriff's sale could have occurred prior to completion. It could have been completed prior to the completion of the trial court altogether. There was nothing stopping that from happening. So, just as has been recognized in Hawaii, which has a very slightly different version of CR 54B, the foreclosure decree is a special kind of order that creates this, makes a final determinations of claims of rights to in a separable form than monetary claims or other claims that may be remaining in the case. There's real property that is set to be transferred through a sheriff's sale. And unless that is appealable as a matter of right at that point, that can't be protected. Going into the merits, Your Honors, the trial court should be affirmed. His plaintiffs admitted to signing the note. They did not contend that the note has been satisfied or that their signatures were forged. The note is clearly enforceable and was properly enforced through the judicial foreclosure action. Washington law is crystal clear on the issue of who has authority to enforce a promissory note through foreclosure. It's the holder of the note endorsed in blank, as it is here.
So is there a question of fact as to whether or not this is an original note that's been produced?
No, there is not, Your Honor, for multiple reasons. First, the plaintiffs admitted to the authenticity by failing to deny the request for admission that were sent after the first summary judgment hearing in which the court found an issue of fact as to that. They attempted to answer more than a year later and then filed a motion to have those answers allowed, which the court ruled on orally denying it but did not enter an order at the summary judgment hearing and the second summary judgment hearing. And so without an order allowing the RFAs to be answered over a year later, they're admitted under CR 36A.
But is the objection, assuming that they weren't excluded by non-admission or denial, isn't it enough to raise a question of fact to say that paper is heavier and the color's not the same?
No, it is not, Your Honor, because those are self-serving statements that were not supported by anything other than Mr. Beverick's statements.
Well, wouldn't they be his personal knowledge of the facts of the physical document?
They are his personal knowledge, Your Honor, but self-serving statements like that are not sufficient to attack a note. And as this court recently addressed in the Bavon case, the self-serving statements like that, especially in that case, it was a show-me-the-note case. The note wasn't ever produced to them. In this case, it was produced. And so by finding that if you can avoid summary judgment just by saying something like that, especially under RCW 62A3308, where they needed to specifically deny the authenticity in their answer, which they didn't, or under ER 902I and J, when there's a commercial paper like this, that is, if you're challenging the authenticity of the signatures or the original, or the authenticity of the note, you need to bring clear and convincing evidence to the court that it is not actually the original. And here, despite over a year since his review of the document and nearly a year from his review to the time he wrote that declaration, he didn't provide any evidence other than his own self-serving statement. And he didn't.
What if he had said, that's not my signature? Could a trier fact find that to be clear and convincing evidence?
Again, I don't think so. He would need to have some evidence if he said, okay, he put in examples of his signature, something to show it's not. In this case, he's not contending it doesn't look like his signature. He's not contending he didn't sign it. He's not contending that the terms are somehow different. In essence, it would be inviting unmeritorious defenses to allow this sort of defense and shift the burden against the evidence rules that are currently in place to add burdens to enforcing creditors who, Your Honor, in literally getting this note and bringing it to the court twice, that's more than is required by the law. And in fact, that would encourage not producing the note in the future so that we could say, oh, we don't have to show you the note. Well, here we're happy to show you the original note. And if you have someone that can show that it's clearly and convincingly not it, fine. But self-serving statements that it looks like it's a color copy, and that's his personal self-serving recollection from 2006 versus today. It's not credible, Your Honor, not sufficient in the face of RCW 62A3308 or ER 902IJ.
Thank you.
Good Morning, Your Honors. Sean Larson Bright of Dorsey & Whitney, and I'm here on behalf of WMC Mortgage. In my very brief time this morning, I just want to highlight a couple of key points pertaining to WMC. The first is that most of the issues on this appeal have no bearing on WMC. Nothing that you've heard in the first 15 minutes of this argument has anything to do with WMC. So these issues about the evidence supporting foreclosure, alleged violations of the Deed of Trust Act, NationStar standing to foreclose, all relate to claims existing between the plaintiffs and the other defendants. WMC is not part of those disputes. So even if this court is inclined to reverse on any of these issues that have been discussed, that doesn't have anything to do with the proper dismissal of the CPA claim against WMC. The second thing I want to note is that this CPA claim against WMC is no different than the many MERS-related CPA claims that have been asserted in recent years, dismissed on summary judgment, and affirmed by this court and others. Since this case was brought 4 years ago, this court and others have repeatedly rejected the very arguments, CPA arguments, being made by the plaintiffs here. Courts have rejected the concept that the mere fact that MERS was initially identified as a beneficiary on the deed of trust is itself an actionable deceptive act. Bain held that it's not a per se deceptive act, and other courts have repeatedly required some deceptive conduct, and there's nothing alleged here. And the other thing is that courts have time and again held that you can't have a CPA claim based on MERS being a beneficiary on the deed of trust unless there's some proof of an actionable injury proximately caused by that. Here, plaintiffs have nothing. The plaintiffs assert some confusion that occurred 5 years after the fact seek to allege that as their injury, and there's really no tie to any misconduct by WMC. So WMC respectfully requests that the summary judgment in its favor be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our calendar. The court will... Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. 4 minutes. See, you change the routine, and there you go.
Your Honor, I apologize.
Proceed.
The lightning round begins.
Proceed.
First of all, I was somewhat surprised by counsel's CR 54B argument. The rule is very clear. If not all the claims have not been disposed of, and the court hasn't made a specific ruling that it is something that can be directed to the Court of Appeals without completing all of the claims, this was a timely appeal. More importantly, let's get back to the promissory note and the counterfeiting of that note. The declaration of Mr. Beverick was responsive to the RFAs in sum and substance, and while it may have been tardy, so what? The fact of the matter is there were facts before the trial court on summary judgment that gave rise to material issues of fact.
What's your specific response to the argument that under the Uniform Commercial Code provision, there's insufficient evidence to raise a material question of fact?
Well, what the rule is, it really goes to the issue of who's the holder. Because under our current regime, which, although I disagree with, I've read those cases, it is the holder of the note, and usually they trot out the original. Who else would have possession under 62A3302? If you don't have it, you don't have it. And a mere copy of it isn't a challenge to the signature any more than a $3 bill. It is the question of whether or not they are, in fact, the holder. If they're not the holder, they don't have standing as a peak to foreclose. If they don't have standing to foreclose, then this whole action was a fraud on the court. And that's the sum and substance of that issue, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is that they want to impose, as I recall, they want clear and convincing evidence. Well, that's a trial standard. That's not a summary judgment standard. Clear and convincing evidence, my client said, I don't think they're the holder of the note because the note that they trotted out wasn't the same document. It had Cyrillic blue as a signature. There was no, we're talking about issues We're not talking conclusory issues. This isn't my note. It isn't my signature. No. He said it isn't the right paper. It isn't the right signature. It isn't the right ink. These are substantive issues which could be addressed to the trial court and should be. That's what was at issue. So we're not, it goes really to the issue of who's the holder. Who is the holder? The other point that I would make, that while, you know, we have a regime now which does not favor the homeowners in many regards, WMC made a comment just a minute ago through its counsel that it doesn't have any responsibility whatsoever, none whatsoever. But I will submit, Your Honors, that if, in fact, the note that was presented by Mr. Hughes was a counterfeit, who then has the note? I would submit that at least one of the parties that could conceivably have that note is WMC. Maybe they are the holders. Maybe they are in possession of the note still in some document archive. We just don't know. So when you get to that, the act of the assignment, when he said, well, there's lots of case law that says MERS is not responsible and merely appointing MERS in the old regime. Of course, if, Your Honor, you were to get a mortgage today through U.S. Bank, you would get a deed of trust that not only has MERS acting on behalf of the bank holding as a nominee, but there would also be a waiver clause to get around the Bain decision. So I would submit that WMC should at least be remanded on that particular issue as to whether or not they still hold the note. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Court will be in recess.
Court is in recess.